Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 327 for July 31st, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes.
Pretty much what happens is the resistance falls apart. It's sort of this show of overwhelming force and overawe the opposition, which, we've been trying to do around the world since then. It worked a lot better in Pennsylvania, and with all those troops there, basically the resistance fell apart.
Dr. Dennis Pogue is Vice President of Preservation at Mount Vernon, and August 1st marks the anniversary of a key date in American history. In 1794, some 7,000 Americans gathered at Braddock's Field in Pennsylvania to protest President George Washington's enforcement of a federal tax on whiskey production. It was one of the biggest days in what's become known as the Whiskey Rebellion, and resulted in Washington leading an army of soldiers into western Pennsylvania to put down the rebellion. More with Dennis Pogue later on, including the first word on the next whiskey to be released from George Washington's distillery at Mount Vernon. I'll also have the calendar of events, the comments of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department returns. First, though, let's look at the week's news. It's brought to you, as always, by Glenmorangie. Friday night, Glenmorangie unveiled its first major new release since the distillery's French owner, La Martinique's, bought it from Glenmorangie back in 2008. It's a 10-year-old single malt matured in Chardonnay wine casks and is being bottled at 40% ABV. It's not the first time Glenmorangie has released a Chardonnay cask bottling. There was one released under Glenmorangie's ownership several years ago. You may still find a bottle of it available here and there. No word yet on just how widely the new Chardonnay cask expression will be available. I want to thank Ian Buxton for passing along the details from Friday night's event in Elgin. And thanks again to Ian for a project we first heard about from him a little over 2 years ago when his book project to honor the late Michael Jackson was released. The check for the proceeds from the book Beer Hunter Whiskey Chaser has now been sent to the Parkinson's Society.
I rounded up half a dozen of the best beer writers and half a dozen of the best whiskey writers and told them they had to write some new material on beer or whiskey, something completely new in a book that was going to commemorate the life of Michael Jackson, and they were not going to get paid. And I asked 12 people, and 12 people instantly agreed. We published the book with some support from the Glenlivet, who underwrote the printing costs. And with the sales of the book now complete, we've donated just over £13,000, about $21,000, to the Parkinson's Disease Society of the United Kingdom. And of course, it was that dreadful Parkinson's disease that Michael suffered from for so many years.
And you've got to be really proud of this now that the project has been completed and all the books are sold. So it's not available anywhere now officially, right?
It's not available to the trade, but there will be copies. I think there are copies still on Amazon. There are probably copies on Abe Books and in some distillery visitor centers who took copies here in Scotland and some brewery visitor centers in England who took copies. There are certainly still some on the shelves.
The check was for the proceeds from sales to distributors. In fact, there are still copies available through Amazon.com and other booksellers. And if you purchase a copy through the WhiskeyCast store, powered by Amazon, I'll donate the small percentage of commissions I get from each sale to a Parkinson's-related charity. The final Sunday in July means one thing for motorsports fans in the U.S. It's Brickyard 400 weekend for NASCAR at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Next year, the Brickyard will have a new name, as Diageo's Crown Royal Canadian Whiskey confirmed rumors that have been circulating around Indianapolis for a few weeks. Crown Royal will become the title sponsor for the Brickyard 400. It'll be known in 2012 as the Crown Royal Presents Your Hero's Name Here 400 at the Brickyard. It's a long name with a good reason. Crown Royal Senior Brand Manager Heather Boyd joined me by phone this week from the Brickyard to explain.
This is going to be an extension of our Your Name Here program that we've been running for the past 6 years, where we give the opportunity for NASCAR fans to nominate heroes and then vote on them to be able to put their hometown heroes' name and lights on the race. So very excited about it and to be announcing this partnership today.
Now, you've done this in the past with the spring race at Richmond. Will that continue and both tracks, or will it just move to Indianapolis starting next year?
Our focus will be with Brickyard next year. Richmond has been a fantastic partner for the past 6 years. They've been very much a great partner for us, you know, with this program in terms of building it to what it is to become today. For 2012, the team at Indianapolis Motor Speedway will be our core partners.
And this will get you a lot more exposure because the Brickyard tends to be a much bigger race on the schedule than the spring race at Richmond, right?
I mean, I think for us, you know, Crown Royal is really all about, you know, celebration. And as we take a look at this event with Your Hero's Name Here, it's really one of the biggest celebrations that we have with the brand. And in partnership with Indianapolis Motor Speedway, that's one of the biggest celebrations in all of motorsports. So we actually feel it's a great combination to be able to take this program to the next level and partner with a track that's one of the most, you know, historic venues in the NASCAR circuit.
Now, how will the Your Hero's Name Here promotion work? We know how it's worked in the past where folks nominate service members and then they're voted on by the general public to name the race in honor of one of these heroes, right?
Mm-hmm. So there'll be a couple of changes from how we run in the past. We're still working out through some of the details of the execution, and we'll be sharing with that in the coming months. But the two key differences is one is our partnership with Indianapolis Motor Speedway. The second is not only are we taking the program to include honoring U.S. military servicemen and women, but we're extending that to all heroes. So across the board, we can have the opportunity to not only nominate those in our military, but those who serve our communities like firefighters, police officers, and local volunteers.
As I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Crown Royal will end its sponsorship of Roush Fenway Racing's number 17 car in the Sprint Cup Series after this season to focus on the Brickyard promotion. Maker's Mark is getting into the White Dog business. Of course, White Dog is what they call the new spirit fresh off the stills in Kentucky. It's known in other parts of the world as New Make Spirit. Maker's White will only be available at the distillery in Loretto, Kentucky. It's being bottled at 90 proof or 45% ABV, which is lower than the distillery's actual White Dog, which is at 130 proof or about 65% ABV. The spirit is diluted with the same spring water used throughout the distillation process at Maker's Mark. Only 130 cases have been produced. Once again, it's only available at the distillery. Now, since we'll be hearing more about how George Washington battled with early American distillers over whiskey taxes, it seems appropriate to mention a couple of new whiskeys coming from some of the craft distillers in the U.S. now. Washington State's Dry Fly Distilling is releasing the first ever Washington-produced bourbon next weekend. The release party is set for Friday night at the Mayflower Hotel near Spokane. There will be about 960 bottles of this three-year-old bourbon available. When it's gone, there won't be any more for at least a couple of years. South Carolina is traditional moonshine country, and a new distillery in Greenville is planning to start selling legal moonshine next month. The Dark Corner Distillery's moonshine will be bottled at 100 proof or 50% ABV and will be 100% unaged corn whiskey. By the way, the distillery gets its name from the Dark Corner region of South Carolina that was a haven for moonshiners and a lot of other illegal activity. And I use that term was pretty loosely. In fact, Reuters reports sheriff's deputies raided an illegal distillery in the Dark Corner last month. They seized 2,000 gallons of moonshine and $150,000 in cash. West Virginia is also known for its moonshining history, but Smooth Ambler Spirits has released a bourbon that's claimed to be very similar to Kentucky bourbons. Yearling bourbon does have something in common with its Kentucky cousins. West Virginia and Kentucky were both originally part of Virginia after the American Revolution, but both eventually became states in their own right as settlers moved west. Got a lot of history in this week's episode. Meanwhile, another nation has signed on to give Scotch whiskey legal protection against imitators. Turkey has agreed to recognize that Scotch whiskey can only be made in Scotland. It's the first time Turkey has given an imported product geographical protection. A couple of social media notes. The Glenlivet has a new Facebook page available, and the Dalmore is now on Twitter. Just look for @DalmoreWhiskey. I've mentioned the plan of Fortune Brands to become a standalone spirits company under the Beam Inc. label as the company spins off its other business units. Fortune announced plans this week to take $1 billion from the sale of its Acushnet golf unit and use it to pay off corporate debt. The sale to a Korean-based investment group was completed this week. The next step is to formally spin off Fortune's home improvement products unit to shareholders. That move is expected later this year. That's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. You could win a trip to visit the Glenmorangie Distillery and meet the 16 Men of Tane. Just visit Glenmorangie's Facebook page to enter. Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. Before I get to the comments of the week, I want to thank everyone who's asked about becoming part of our new community panel or one of the tasting panels for the new WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings podcast that debuts in August. We've had a lot of interest from all over the world, and I'll be getting in touch with those of you who have emailed soon, but we always have room for more community members to join in both panels. If you're interested, send an email to comments@whiskeycast.com, and please put either community panel or tasting panel or, shoot, even both in the subject line. One thing I should have mentioned last week, if you're working in the whiskey industry, even if it's just at a liquor store, unfortunately, you're not eligible to be part of a tasting panel. We want to make sure there are no appearances whatsoever of conflicts of interest. Also, last week I mentioned the exhibition prints that are now available at the WhiskeyCast website. Since then, I've added another 6 prints to the catalog. They're still priced at $75 each for 11x14 prints on 16x20 paper, but that price will go up when the new WhiskeyCast website comes online soon. If you're looking for a way to give your whiskey room, office, or bar a unique look, check the gallery at the website. They also make great gifts, too. Now, let's get to the comments of the week, brought to you this time around by the folks at Highland Park. Paul Gagnon posted a request for help on the Facebook page this week. Here's what he had to say. Hi, Mark. I'm heading to Japan this weekend and will be listening to some WhiskeyCast episodes on the long flight to catch up. I want to take advantage of being in Japan to bring back some unique Japanese whiskeys that we can't get in the States. Do you or your listeners have any suggestions as to what would be worth seeking out? I'd like to bring back some Nikko whiskeys, but maybe there are others worth finding. Thanks for the great information, Slancha. Well, when it comes to help with Japanese whiskeys, I defer to Chris Bunting, a fellow malt maniac and the blogger behind Nonjata. You've probably heard him on WhiskeyCast a couple of times before. Since he's based in Japan, he has access to many of the whiskeys that are never exported outside the country. There's a link for Nonjata on the resources page of the WhiskeyCast website under News and Views. Here's another request for help. Mike Walsh will be in the Cleveland area soon, and he's looking for a good whiskey bar. I haven't been there myself, so I don't have any good ideas. If you have a suggestion, let me know, and I'll pass it on to Mike. That's not just limited to Cleveland, though. If you know of a good whiskey bar anywhere in the world that deserves some love, just pass along the details. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com, and you can also post them on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, too. The comments of the week are brought to you this time around by Highland Park.
Hello, this is Jerry Tosh of Highland Park, the makers of the best spirit in the world. If you'd like to go onto the WhiskeyCast website and click on the banner, then it'll take you to the inner circle and sign up, and we'll send you as much information about Highland Park as you'd ever need to know.
Time now for the calendar of events, brought to you as always by Laphroaig. There's a tasting of Boonehaven and the other Burn Stewart whiskeys on August 3rd at Julio's Liquors in Westboro, Massachusetts. Julio's will also host a Dalmore tasting with Richard Patterson on August 9th. Whiskey Fringe is this coming weekend in Edinburgh, Scotland. The Whiskey Lounge in the UK will hold Bluffer's Guide to Whiskey classes in London August 22nd, Manchester August 26th, and Newcastle on the 27th. The Köpenicker Whiskey Herbst will be September 2nd and 3rd in Berlin, Germany, along with Whiskey Live in Shanghai, China. Whiskey Live Glasgow is September 3rd, and tickets are still available for the Whiskey Guild's annual Whiskey Classic Tasting Cruise in New York City on September 8th. The Kentucky Bourbon Festival is September 13th through the 18th in Bardstown. Whiskey Live Moscow is September 16th and 17th, and Whiskey Live Paris is September 24th through the 26th. Those are just a few of the events coming up over the next couple of months. You'll find a full calendar at the WhiskeyCast website. It's brought to you by Laphroaig, which has an all-new website for you at Laphroaig.com, including a new Friends of Laphroaig area, where you can become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla. This week on WhiskeyCast In-Depth, we're looking at a debt crisis in the United States, but this one was back in the 1790s. There are some parallels to today, though. The administration of President George Washington needed to raise a whopping $54 million to retire federal and state debts. In 1790, Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton suggested a tax on whiskey production to raise revenue. Washington and the Congress agreed. But back then, many farmers were turning their extra grain into whiskey, and most of them did everything they could to avoid the whiskey tax. The situation festered until 1794, when a tax on federal agents led to the Whiskey Rebellion, and an army of 13,000 federal troops marched into western Pennsylvania, led personally by President Washington. Dr. Dennis Pogue is Vice President of Preservation at Mount Vernon, Washington's estate, and one of the leading experts on George Washington. His new book, Founding Spirits, will be published this fall.
The legislation is introduced in 1790. It's actually passed in 1791. The reason for it, of course, is that the Washington administration is looking for revenues to bail out, you know, the debt. It takes a number of years. Off and on, the federal government, they send out, revenue agents to collect the tax. It's kind of passively resisted for a number of years. It's not until 1794 when conflict really breaks out.
So it's almost sort of like a whiskey party rebellion, as we see with the Tea Party Rebellion a few years earlier in Boston Harbor almost. You could sort of claim it like that, right?
Well, you could. some people felt that way. The argument that was made by lots of folks who resisted, you know, the tax was, look, you know, we've just fought a revolution to break away from a government because we thought we were being unfairly taxed. And they equate, you know, what the Washington administration is doing with the whiskey tax, you know, to that situation. Where Washington and Hamilton and the federal government differed from that was to say that, look, back in the old days, you were not represented in your government, and that's completely different now. You know, this is a representative government. You know, you've elected officials to go and represent you and all of that, and so this is not, you know, a situation that's comparable.
And we need to explain that this is pre-Washington, the distiller himself. So he had not actually entered the whiskey business himself at this time, so this wasn't one distiller trying to tax another at the time.
It wasn't, and certainly it had nothing to do with, you know, Washington had no opposition to alcohol, to consumption of alcohol, or anybody's right to make it. You know, from his perspective, what this was all about was, you know, getting revenues for the federal government so that it could do its job, number one. And then number two, when the folks decided that they were going to resist that, he was all about, you know, showing that it was the federal government's authority to do this. And so he reacted very strongly, you know, to the rebellion, actually was the first and only, you know, president of the United States to lead troops into the field in 1794, when they took about 13,000 militiamen out to western Pennsylvania, you know, to put down the resistance.
Now, what really happened in 1794 that sparked all this, to where the rebellion went from passive to active rebellion?
Well, again, you know, for years, folks had been resisting efforts to collect the tax. And in 1794, the government sent another group of tax collectors out, you know, into these areas, and sort of with a redoubled effort. And so there was resistance to this, you know, in pretty much all the frontier areas, not just western Pennsylvania. But for whatever reason, that was the area where it got kicked off, and actually there was gunfire. There was fighting between local folks and revenue agents, and so that's really kind of the spark that led Washington to decide that he needed to show, you know, a real serious show of force to put this down before it got, you know, out of hand.
Is this something that could have brought down the government at that time had it gotten out of hand?
Well, you know, it's always hard to say, but I think all, what we can say is that, you know, the president, you know, felt it was such a serious, you know, issue that, you know, they raised 13,000 troops and he led them into the field. So I think that that's an indication that he thought it was a serious threat.
And I don't ask that question lightly because if you follow, for our listeners, if you follow any of the historical documents of the time, there were many points in the history of the United States after the Revolutionary War and really up until right around the War of 1812, where the Republic could have collapsed at any point because of various disputes and infighting at this time, right?
Well, sure. We look back at history, you know, we look back at the Revolution in particular, and then everything since then with an assumption that it was going to succeed, because it did succeed. But it's only when you look at the details of these events that you realize what an iffy matter, you know, a lot of this is, and certainly could have gone wrong a number of different times, and we would be in a very, very different situation today.
Now, 1794, Washington raises the 13,000 troops and heads to western Pennsylvania, basically what we now know in the area around Washington, Pennsylvania, rather ironically, but between the Washington, Pennsylvania area and Pittsburgh, really, right?
That's correct.
And what happens there?
Well, pretty much what happens is the resistance falls apart. You know, it's sort of this, you know, show of overwhelming force and, you know, overawe the opposition, which, you know, we've been trying to do around the world since then. It worked a lot better in Pennsylvania, and with all those troops there, basically the resistance fell apart. And so they were able to just sort of, you know, mop it up and clamp it down, and that was really the end of it.
But as that resistance fell apart, a lot of the instigators really just sort of moved further west and a little bit south down to Kentucky, right?
They did, although some people, I think, give too much, you know, credit to this as an impetus for moving to the west. There was already, one of the benefits of winning the Revolutionary War is that American farmers could move west of the Appalachians. And so there was already a big influx of immigrants, you know, past the mountains into the Ohio and Kentucky territories. In the 1780s and 1790s before the Whiskey Rebellion.
What kind of historical parallels can we draw towards more current times and more recent history from the Whiskey Rebellion?
Well, it's the age-old question that's dominated American politics for the last 200 years, which is the role of the central government and, you know, how big a role that should have and, you know, how the states and the localities, you know, relate to that, and so we're in a republic, and so, you know, that means that you've elected leaders and you're asking them to make good decisions for you, and sometimes folks don't feel that they're being represented effectively, and then these kinds of things break out. That's been happening for 200 years, and it's going on right now, I think.
What was the state of Pennsylvania's role in all this at the time?
I don't think that they were, well, I mean, certainly western Pennsylvania was the major theater for this. So there were, you know, leaders in Pennsylvania who strongly opposed it. You know, it never got to the point where the state of Pennsylvania ever made any noises about, you know, officially resisting the tax or seceding or anything like that. But there were certainly a lot of fairly highly thought of leaders in Pennsylvania who were a part of the rebellion.
Now, you mentioned earlier that Washington had no objection to alcohol. But one of the things that we see occasionally, even still today, is that those who are opposed to alcohol use will use Washington as sort of a figurehead for that, and I'm not sure where this comes from, but they would basically tried to use Washington's positions on alcohol publicly, which may have differed from his own private views. Can you explain that sort of conflict that we've seen over the last 200 years post-Washington?
Sure. Well, you know, this goes back to the fact that everybody wants George Washington on their side. And so, you know, people are just impose a lot of values and ideas on not just Washington, but the founding fathers, because they're such, you know, they still serve such an important role, you know, in our national, you know, legacy, and impute things to these guys that I think they would be surprised to learn. And certainly that's one of them. There was a temperance society that was established in the 1840s called the Washington Temperance Society, and they use George Washington as a symbol of their campaign, and you know, argued, you know, that Washington, you know, opposed the use of alcohol, which was certainly untrue. So we see that happening a lot. In fact, in my new book, Founding Spirits, George Washington and the Beginnings of the American Whiskey Industry, you know, I write about this, and I've got illustrated a temperance badge from the Temperance Society that has the inscription, "We bear a patriot's honored name. Our country's welfare is our aim." So, pretty ironic stuff.
Especially considering that Washington was a distiller.
And he was a distiller, and not only a distiller, but it turns out that he operated one of the largest whiskey distilleries in the country at the time.
How did he progress from the presidency to basically being the leader of the whiskey industry?
Well, you know, he's in 1797, when Washington, you know, comes back to Mount Vernon after 8 years as president. He's an old man. He's 65 years old. And he's looking to the future and, frankly, is looking for a way to, you know, make money that's a little bit easier than running, you know, an 8,000-acre plantation with 300 slaves and all the things that he'd been doing. As it happens, he hired a Scotsman by the name of James Anderson to be his plantation manager. And Anderson had experience distilling both in Scotland before he came to this country and then after he got here. And so he almost immediately lobbied Washington with the idea that if he'll pay for it, he knows everything about it, and he can make him a lot of money if they establish a whiskey distillery. And Washington's initially, you know, skeptical, but he writes around to some, you know, friends of his to get their opinion, and they write back and say, yeah, as long as he has a good product, there's no doubt that you can sell it. So he agreed, and in 1797, they started out small, and they bought a couple of stills and set up in an existing building, made a few hundred gallons of whiskey, made a healthy profit, and by the end of that year, Washington agreed to expand the operation and build a new still house dedicated to the operation, bought three more stills, and within a year, they were making almost 11,000 gallons of rye whiskey, which turns out that makes it one of the largest whiskey distilleries in the country.
And part of his research was checking with the general store owners in the area around Mount Vernon and finding that they couldn't keep enough rye whiskey in stock, right?
No.
At least, that's one of the stories I've heard, was that they were having shortages of whiskey at the time, and that's one of the reasons why he saw an opportunity.
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. You're the expert on this one, so if you haven't heard it, then...
Well, he sold a lot. I mean, he did sell his whiskey. Most of it was sold, you know, very, very nearby. And in 1799, about 4,500 gallons, he sold to merchants in nearby Alexandria. And then they would have turned around and sold it, you know, through their retail outlets. So he was serving that market. But I don't think he had done any, you know, previous research to lead him in that direction.
Now, back to the Whiskey Rebellion for a second. How much of the decision to launch a military operation in western Pennsylvania, how much of this was Washington's decision, and how much of it came from Alexander Hamilton, who was Secretary of the Treasury and was responsible for collecting all these taxes? Was Washington sort of carrying the water politically for Hamilton on this, or was it the other way around?
Well, they were very close on this. I mean, both Hamilton and Washington were, you know, they were very strong Federalists. In other words, you know, they strong supporters, you know, of the central government's, you know, ability to do these kinds of things. And Hamilton was the Secretary of the Treasury. You know, he's the money guy, so he's the one who comes up with the plan, you know, for this taxation system. But Washington is completely supportive of it. You know, they see eye to eye. And then when the outbreak, you know, comes out, I think it's and Washington and Hamilton, of course, had served together in the Revolution. Hamilton was a junior officer on Washington's staff for many years. So they saw eye to eye, you know, militarily as well. So I think it was, I don't think there was much separation between them in their opinions on the overall event and what they needed to do to take care of it.
Is it fair to say that Washington paid all the taxes on his whiskey?
It's not really fair to say, but we can prove it. We have the ledgers at Mount Vernon that were kept during the period that Washington operated the distillery, and in the ledgers we can see the notations for his paying the tax.
And you have a whole bunch of these old records that really indicated all this, but why did we never learn about this in school? Why did we never hear that Washington not only, we heard that he retired to Mount Vernon, but we never heard the part about him owning slaves very much, and we sure never heard about him making whiskey.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's because probably a lot of things are going into that. One is that Washington was such an icon. His public role as, you know, the first president and really the main one in the Revolution was so prominent that it kind of crowded everything else out. But what's happened, I think, over the last several decades is that folks have become more interested, you know, in, you know, the behind the scenes stories of these things. And one of the things we've been doing at Mount Vernon for the last 25 years is trying to, you know, tell more of those stories. And so the story of Washington as a slaveholder, it's not the brightest part of his career, but it's a historical fact, and it was hugely important to his success. And so now we do a lot on that, telling that story. And then the same thing with, you know, his whiskey career. Who knew that Washington, you know, ran a whiskey distillery? Not very many folks, but we feel that that's an inherently interesting story that, you know, gives a real insight into Washington, shows him as a very canny, successful, you know, entrepreneurial businessman. And it's just got some natural interest that we find folks have. So it's a great way to get that across.
What else is happening at the distillery now that you're actually making some whiskey there in the restored distillery and put the second batch on sale last month, and or earlier this month, rather, and pretty much sold it out in another hour or two again?
Yeah, we did. You know, when we started this project, 10 years ago, you know, we never really thought that we were going to be making whiskey on any kind of, you know, regular basis. And it's really just because people are so interested, you know, in the story and in the product and, you know, wanting to know, you know, okay, what did George Washington's whiskey taste like, that we've really, you know, sort of come around to doing that. And we've actually made, I think, 3 batches of whiskey now, and they've all, you know, sold out, you know, almost immediately. And we will continue to do that. We're certainly not planning on getting into the commercial liquor industry. Plenty of fine folks in Kentucky who do a great job with that. We don't feel we need to get in there. But it's on a small scale. It's primarily an educational opportunity. I think it fits with our mission very well.
And the distillery is actually open to the public every day during the summer and early fall, right?
It is. From April through October, 7 days a week, you can come and not only see how the whiskey was made in the distillery, but next door you can go across and you can see how the grain was ground that then would have come over to the distillery to be turned into whiskey. So you can really go out there, and it's the only place in the country where you can see how whiskey was made 200 years ago.
And one of the cool things that you do is bring in, through the participation of DISCUS, the Distilled Spirits Council, which provided a lot of the funding to restore the distillery, a lot of the current master distillers from many of the distilleries in Kentucky and Virginia and all over the place to actually come in and make whiskey with the staff at Mount Vernon, right?
Absolutely correct. And we've, of course, gotten, you know, wonderful help over the years, not only, you know, financially in terms of donations to make the building possible, but also in terms of expertise and all kind of other support. We've had Jimmy Russell there and Chris Morris and just, you know, David Pickerel from Maker's Mark, and all kinds of folks have come in and worked with us over the years. So it's been a learning experience, you know, for us, and I think also for them. You know, it's not very often that they, you know, actually sit down and with 150-gallon still, you know, over an open fire to make this stuff.
The way that it was made literally 200 years ago, and the way the early bootleggers over in Scotland made it in caves, and when they came over here and made it in back in the hills as well.
Sure, and of course the micro-distilling, you know, movement has really taken off. When we started this project about 10 years ago, you know, it really didn't exist. I mean, there were, you know, Fritz Maytag and a few other folks were out there making small batches of whiskey, but just within the last few years, of course, you know, as you well know, it's just become, you know, a growth industry.
Mm-hmm.
And we like to think that we may have played some part in that, because there's been, you know, lots and lots of attention paid to this project, and I think that may have helped.
Yeah, you guys may be the original craft distillery almost. I think you probably got the smallest stills anybody's using anywhere.
Yeah. Pretty much, and nobody that I know of is distilling over open wood fires, so that makes it pretty unique.
The one thing I've always wanted to know when I come down there and look at the distillery, I know you're making the whiskey, but I have no idea where you're keeping it for storage.
Well,
I assume it's in some sort of undisclosed secure location somewhere at Mount Vernon.
That's right, Mark. If you knew, I'd have to kill you. you know, we've got basically a bunker on the estate. You know, that's a bonded warehouse, and you know, that's where we keep it. So we make it there, it's at a story, then it gets transported back over to the estate for storage.
When will the next batch go on sale?
Well, we have a couple of things in the works. You know, we have, in addition to putting out the unaged rye, which of course is what Washington's, you know, spirit was like. It was, you know, completely clear. You know, there was no attempt to age it. But knowing that people are interested in that as well, we have been putting some of the product that we make each time, you know, into the bunker in oak barrels for aging. And so our first batch of about 2.5 year old now, aged rye whiskey is going to come available this fall. And so keep a lookout, go to our webpage, and you should see an ad for that sometime in either October or November where this is going to be available.
Will it be sold only at Mount Vernon, or will you make it available through the Virginia ABC stores?
Well, sadly, we are an ABC store. We are a licensed ABC store. But this is the only place where we can sell it. And of course, you know, the volume is just tiny. We've been selling about, you know, 500 bottles of the unaged rye each time, and that's what will be available, you know, this fall as well. So, and it goes so quickly here that it's just impossible to distribute it much more widely than that.
I take it you've stored a few bottles away for yourself, right?
Well, no, actually not. I have purchased a couple of bottles of the unaged rye, one to keep as a keepsake and one so that I can offer it to friends around here. But other than that, that's all I have.
Well, put me on the list for one of those aged ryes when it goes on sale. I'll be glad to buy a bottle of it then.
You'll be the first. I'll make sure that you're one of the first to know, Mark.
Of course, I'll let you know when the Mount Vernon rye will be on sale. By the way, Dennis's book is available now at the Mount Vernon Gift Shop. It is not available yet, though, through Amazon, but I'll let you know when it is. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with the Blackadder's Smoking Isla. This is part of Blackadder's Single Cask Series. 258 bottles are headed for the U.S. at 45% ABV. The distillery is not named, but the nose has great peatiness with a slight pepperiness. The taste is peaty, smoky, and rich, with a touch of caramel syrup underneath and a hint of oak. The finish is long and smoky with brown sugar and caramel touches underneath. It's very nice. I'm giving it a score of 90. The Black Bull Special Reserve, batch number 1 from Duncan Taylor, is bottled at 46.6% ABV. The nose is smoky and peppery with oak and a touch of lemon. The taste is thick and spicy with black pepper and a lemony tartness underneath. Now the pepper lingers nicely into the finish, which is long with a slight lemony tartness too. It's very consistent with a good balance. I'm scoring the Black Bull Special Reserve Batch Number 1 an 88. I mentioned the Arkansas Young Bourbon from Rocktown Distillery a couple of weeks ago. It's bottled at 46% ABV. The nose is fiery with roasted corn, butter, oak, and a bit of vanilla. The taste has pepper and chili powder with touches of vanilla, oak, and brown sugar underneath. And those notes linger through the finish. It's young, but very interesting. And I'm scoring it an 83. I need to note that these tasting notes are all from samples provided by the distillery. And you should know that, hey, your tastes may differ from mine, so try these for yourself. Don't just take my word for it, because, after all, your mileage may vary. Now, you'll find all of my tasting notes in the free smartphone apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. The Apple edition is sponsored by the Glenrothes, the Android edition by Ben Romick. They're also available at the WhiskeyCast website, and that's also where you'll find links for our Facebook community page and my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, the photo gallery and print shop, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. I'd love to hear from you. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.